From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Governor Snyder has a change of heart about President Obama's visit this week to Flint.
Can the governor afford to be seen as snubbing a president that he's asking for help from?
Which may be why the governor is now asking to meet with the president. Plus, a sick out by Detroit teachers shuts most of the city's schools.
You know, we don't want to feel like sellouts, people that just want money so that we can get a paycheck. We really want what's best for Detroit.
His daughter was the youngest victim in the Kalamazoo mass shooting. As Abby Kopf recovers, her dad works for an end to gun violence.
Right now, we as a country seem to say, oh, another shooting, grit our teeth, walk forward like nothing ever happened.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Teaching Michigan students about the Holocaust is crucial, but teachers need to approach those lessons the right way.
What we've found is that when good questions are activated in the classroom, it doesn't lead to easy answers. What it leads to is more questions, deeper questions, questions that are more informed.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, how one Michigan teacher is helping his peers to teach the lessons of the Holocaust. But first, just about every Detroit public school was closed today when teachers staged a mass sick out. That protest followed an announcement by emergency manager Stephen Rhodes that the district will not be able to make payroll after June 30th. Now, most Detroit teachers spread their paychecks through the year. So that means if this happens, as of last Thursday, they won't be getting paid. Detroit teacher Sarah Jardine is with us now from the teacher protest happening outside the Fisher Building. Sarah, what do you, as a member of the DFT rank and file, want?
We're caught in this really bad position now where, Judge Rhodes is saying that there is no money to give us after June 30th, including the money that's been set aside out of our paycheck to last us over the summertime. And the problem is that he's saying that the way that we get paid is that they have to pass these Senate packages. And these Senate packages are actually, to the rank and file, very distasteful. And, you know, many of us do not think that this is what Detroit needs or that they want, actually. So we feel like we're caught between a rock and a hard place where, you know, he's saying we won't get paid unless they pass these bills. And yet these bills, to many of us, seem like a very bad idea for public school in Detroit.
So what would be your demands? What's the rank and file's demands?
The rank and file has been getting together. We had another planning meeting last night where we just heard from teachers and asked them, you know, what do you want? We met after we had an emergency union meeting and said, is the union saying what the rank and file feels? And by and large, we were getting that that's actually not the case, that most of us are not supportive of the Senate packages. Interestingly, we just had this rally and we had shut down the streets and we were walking in the streets and many of us wanted to chant old co, new co, we say hell no. And the AFT organizers would not let us chant that. So we are in an interesting division between what the rank and file wants and what the union wants. And what the rank and file wants is we would like, and the union does agree with this point, that we want an audit. We want them to figure out what's been happening with the money. I'm sure all over the state, everyone's wondering what's happening with the money. And we are, too. We want to know what is going on. And we think that's only fair. And then if a lot of that was accrued from mismanagement under state control, we feel like the state is responsible for that debt. We don't need to break up Detroit public schools into old co and new co and all these, you know, creative terms. We just need the state to pay the portion that it was responsible for when we were under management of the state. We're also asking that, we be paid. So that's the third thing. And then the last thing is that we really feel like every other school district in the state, we should have a fully empowered school board. It's only fair that Detroit is governed just like every other school district in the state. The voters have a right to decide their representation and to have that representation be able to do the things that they need to do to get things done in Detroit public schools. And that's not happening. And the Senate bill doesn't appear to make that so either.
in the sense with you among the rank and file is that your union leadership and DFT President Ivy Bailey is really pushing more for this new co, old co thing.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. If DFT leadership and the DFT rank and file are not on the same page, how's that going to help your cause? Or I guess the other side of that coin is, will it hurt your cause?
I think that there's many of us that feel like, you know, we really want to follow our heart. We're standing in front of children every day, and we have to look at them, and we look at their parents, and, you know, we don't want to feel like sellouts, people that just want money so that we can get a paycheck. We really want what's best for Detroit. And we don't know if the outcome of all of this will impact us negatively. You're right, it could. This division could really, you know, turn out to be something that causes problems for all of us. But at the end of the day, we have to look these kids in the face and do what's right by them. And I can't do that looking at these Senate packages. I can't tell their parents that I was willing to, you know, risk, you know, their democracy to get money. I can't do that. And I know that many teachers feel the same. We just want what's best for Detroit. And we don't see why democracy isn't best for Detroit.
How far are you personally, Sarah, prepared to take this protest?
Well, at this point, we will find out within the next couple of days the will of the membership. I think the will is there to continue until there's a resolution. I do. I think that there probably will be a meeting upcoming, and we'll make some decisions, and hopefully the will is there, in my opinion, to take this as long as it needs to be taken to get the results that we need.
Sarah Jardine is a Detroit teacher taking part in today's district-wide sick-out. Sarah, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Time now for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon. And John, the NFL looked over the available crop of college prospects. The draft is done. First off, for the lightly interested or the uninitiated, being drafted does not automatically mean you're going to be in the lineup come fall, does it?
Not by a long shot. There are seven rounds of drafts. Each team basically gets seven draft picks. But the Lions, for example, have 10 this year because they traded up and all this other stuff. You can trade four draft picks. But of the 10 guys they got, maybe five or six might make this roster, six or seven. Mm. So it's not any guarantee. Furthermore, even if you get that far, the number of high-priced flameouts is legendary, by the way. Ryan Leaf still takes the cake as the second pick overall a few years ago, who cost him millions of dollars and was abysmal. Now we've got Johnny Manziel, the
yes.
Cleveland Browns. He was now at a Buffalo Wild Wings watching this thing on TV. He's done.
Wow.
2 years later. So one of Bo's great lines, until you're in my helmet, I can't tell what you can do. And we all know this from the hiring process. Everyone out there does hiring, of course. Resumes and interviews sound really great. Until you get them on the job, you really don't know what you get. That's the NFL.
What are your thoughts on how new Lions GM Bob Quinn did for his first draft for Detroit?
Overall, nationally, he received like a B- overall, and this is not great inflation. The C is average in this grading system. I give him higher than that. I think he did a very good job. They had 10 picks, and five of them he spent on linemen, which does not get headlines. Quarterbacks get headlines. Receivers get headlines. But linemen is what you need and what the Lions need especially. So I think it's a very good draft for him.
But speaking of quarterbacks, we know Michigan quarterback Jake Rudock went in the sixth round of the Lions.
That's right.
And yes, the whole world went to great lengths to point out, hey, that's the same round Tom Brady went back in 2000. Should we stop the comparisons right
there? We should. Tom Brady was an excellent quarterback throughout college. He had to split his time, probably unfairly, with Drew Henson, the upcoming freshman phenom, for reasons that aren't entirely clear, to be honest, and then took a little while to get going. Rudock was maxing out his talent last year. His talent expanded last year. That was through Jim Harbaugh, and that, by the way, what they did with that guy is a great billboard to go to Michigan if you're a quarterback. He was a grad transfer, unheralded. Mm-hmm. In September, not very good. In November, he's winning them games.
Does he have a shot?
He's got a real shot. He's going to make the team, I think. He'll be wearing a baseball cap and a clipboard for a couple years, but Stafford's got the job, Matt Stafford.
Yes.
That's not a bad way to get it started. He's going to make an NFL paycheck.
Now we have to talk about Connor Cook, MSU's quarterback, who twisted in the wind for a while and finally went to the Oakland Raiders in the fourth round. Here's a guy that was Big Ten quarterback of the year. MSU's winning in his quarterback. Two Big Ten championships, wins in the Rose Bowl and Cotton Bowl. Why did a guy considered to be a first-rounder drop so far back?
Something is rotten in Denmark, as Shakespeare would say.
Yes.
Were he analyzing the NFL draft? look, you listed his pedigree. It's incredibly impressive, and he's not that far ahead of Jake Rudock, who's got none of those things. None of them. Two things have happened. One is his shoulder might be a question. He blew off all the All-Star games, so the shoulder might not be as good as advertised. Two is personality, frankly. He's not the captain of his team, and a lot's been made of that. Usually a star quarterback almost automatically is the captain of his team, and he's not. And I will say these NFL guys do a lot of homework. They've talked to his teammates. They've talked to his coaches. They've talked to others. So there's something about that guy they do not like.
I'd love your thoughts on one of the stories that jumped out at me. Willie Beavers of Western Michigan,
yes,
drafted in the fourth round by Minnesota. Tell us this kid's story, because at one point it looked like total heartache.
It was total heartache. This guy was dying to play Big Ten football. And Tim Beckman, the former coach of the Illinois Fighting Illini, mm-hmm, offered him a scholarship. He gets on campus, even. And they do what's called oversigning, which means you have 25 scholarships and you invite 30, and then five basically get blown off, is how it works. Tim Beckman, by the way, the Illinois coach, I'm going to say it, he's a bad guy. He got fired for abusing his players physically and verbally. There's a lot of examples of that. And this guy, Willie Beavers, got caught in this and ended up going to Western Michigan. So he's heartbroken. Well, guess who's in the NFL and guess who isn't? Tim Beckman's out of a job, and Willie Beavers is about to sign a nice, big, fat contract. So good for you, young man.
That's a great story.
He's getting the last laugh.
He is getting the last laugh. Finally, just since we last talked, the NCAA backed off, reversed its ban on satellite camps. Why do you think they did that?
Not because they suddenly realize they're unjust or hypocritical, but because they realize it is far harder to defend these than it is to dump them. So what the NCAA does is stick their finger in the wind, see which way the wind is blowing, and the blowback from this was far greater than they had imagined. So they're playing politics, and this one lost.
Was the question done for now, or do you think there'll be renewed efforts from the SEC to keep Jim Harbaugh out of their territory?
I think this should humble the SEC a little bit, that they no longer control the whole world, as they thought they did. But they're still immensely paranoid about Jim Harbaugh, and they'll still try to think of some way, somehow, to stop him. They're not going to.
So for now, Harbaugh gets the last laugh.
And I'm sure he's enjoying it.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubanks. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Obama's trip to Flint this Wednesday had political observers in the state watching and wondering, would Governor Snyder meet with the president? Early signs indicated no, especially when the governor told the Detroit News last week he had, quote, a pretty full schedule and wasn't scheduled to be in Flint Wednesday when the president visits. But this morning brought a new tune. The governor asked to meet with President Obama and Flint's Mayor Karen Weaver. Let's turn to Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team of Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark to dig into this a little bit. Rick, the governor went from, gee, I'm really, really busy that day, to can we meet? What's behind the change of heart, do you think?
Yeah, well, there have been a lot of us who've been, you know, asking, will he or won't he? On the one hand, the governor's been stuck on defense when it comes to dealing with the Flint water crisis. And certainly there were a lot of reasons for him to not want to be there, to, you know, have to endure all the criticism that would come into play during the president's visit to Flint. On the other hand, this is the president of the United States coming to Michigan to check in on the biggest crisis currently facing the Snyder administration, and one in which the governor is looking for federal assistance to help out. So was there any way that he could not greet the president, not meet with the president while the president is visiting Flint?
Well, absolutely. And I think this is what has now led to this Monday morning news that we're all seeing, which is now that Governor Snyder says, oh, well, now I am requesting a visit or at least some sort of meeting with both the president and Flint Mayor Karen Weaver.
And then there was a little poke at Governor Snyder from the White House press secretary, Josh Earnest, at today's daily briefing.
Well, thanks, Josh. I want to follow up on one of Justin's questions about the Flint trip. Governor Snyder told reporters this morning he's looking to meet with the president. So yeah, is that meeting going to happen?
I guess his schedule got a little freed up, huh?
I guess so. Yeah.
Some political cattiness here, Zoe?
Yes, and I think that's how everyone took it when we all heard this answer from Josh Earnest. It was exactly as you say. Well, look at what happened. And I think it was because over the weekend there were a lot of political pundits going, is this really what you want to do? As Rick said, when it's not just a meeting, but actually some dollars and some federal help on the line.
And don't discount the optics of the situation as well, that can the governor afford to be seen as snubbing a president that he's asking for help from? Is that very bipartisan?
Yeah.
Is that very nonpartisan? Is that practical problem solving?
Of course, though, you can look at the other side. And a few years ago during the heated 2012 election, when Republican Governor Chris Christie, mm-hmm, of New Jersey gave Obama, of course, the Democrat, a big old hug when Obama came came to his state with some federal relief for Hurricane Sandy and a lot of Republicans saying, you know, how dare you do that?
And I wondered if there would be the political downside that Rick Snyder might suffer here in Michigan for basically doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And there's another thing, too, which is that, you know, the governor is trying to broaden the narrative on his administration so that it's not so focused on Flint. The administration very frustrated that the Flint crisis has overshadowed some of the successes of the Snyder administration, the improving employment rate, the Detroit rescue, paying off a lot of debt. All of those things are out of sight, out of mind, while the Flint crisis remains active. And now in comes the president of the United States to call even more attention to that, if it's possible to call more attention to what's going on in Flint.
Right. Although, you know, one of the things that Rick and I were talking about earlier was this idea that for any, you know, political operation, which, of course, is somewhat what is running in a governor's office, is the pros and cons of this kind of thing. And one of the cons you have to assume is, you know, what kind of audience will the governor and President Obama have if they do meet? And one of the things that Rick and I were talking about this morning, and it's just politics, is this idea of the governor is probably not likely to sit in an audience with other folks while Obama, you know, stands up and addresses people. So if we see some kind of big speech right in front of a couple hundred folks in Flint, I mean, he's probably going to say, these are the problems that happened, and they were because of state government. And it's likely we're not going to see Snyder sitting, you know, either on stage with Obama when that's happening, of
course.
Right. And so instead we were then kind of doing the machinations of, okay, well, is it, you know, a handshake on the tarmac, right, at Flint Bishop Airport, you know, Obama lands, and then is Snyder there, and then he can at least, you know, do a handshake. You know, the headlines won't be, you know, Snyder snubs President Obama.
He but now that he wants a meeting, that's
well,
different.
But, and that's what's so interesting now is now it's not just going to be that. It's going to be, well, okay, now I do want to sit down with you. And to note, too, Karen Weaver, who Snyder has had some strained relations with.
Interesting. And we have a meeting of lame ducks here.
We do. We do. Although, you know, Barack Obama, his approval ratings are actually, you know, quite high. He's only got 9 months left to go, and it's looking pretty good for him. Rick Snyder's approval ratings are, you know, off in the other direction, and he's hoping to actually maybe, you know, bend things in a different direction vis-a-vis Flint. We should also, you know, point out that, you know, the president is expected to, you know, meet with a lot of people and address an audience. And that's the kind of function that Rick Snyder has avoided in favor of more closely managed one-on-one meetings, visits to homes, things like that when it comes to actually interacting with the people of Flint.
And that's what we saw just earlier today when he was at a pub in Flint filling up some more gallons of water. So
he visited a reporter's home.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say, you know, highly staged events in terms of, you know, a small amount of people. And likely, again, that will be the kind of setting if there is now this presidential meeting.
Well, now, do either of you think there's any chance President Obama might just be too busy to meet with Governor Snyder? Is that a possibility?
It's a possibility, but I think in the end that there will be some sort of meetup between the two of them, even if it's just a handshake on the tarmac.
I agree, because I think, again, this crisis has gotten big enough that there is a sense of folks needing to work together. Now, I am not saying that I think that means that the whole, you know, Republican state delegation is going to be there, that, you know, Republican lawmakers are going to be there, you know, as Obama chides them for not, you know, approving more money. I think we will see a photo op of some type of the governor and Obama.
But, you know, the handshake on the tarmac, I think, would come off as a snub now, Obama to Snyder, versus, you know, now that there's been a request for a meeting, because that's not a meeting.
Yeah.
That's a photo op.
Well, it's definitely some chess moves, isn't it? All coming from just having too busy of a schedule, which, you know, of course, this is a governor, too. We should note that flew back, you know, from overseas a few summers ago when he was trying to push for some funding from the legislature. So, you know,
for the Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, Medicaid expansion.
Big Barack
Obama
program. For Obama,
right. So let's remember that folks are able to move schedules when they need to.
And Rick Snyder and, you know, President Obama have shown that they can cooperate on some things. when it's both in their mutual interest.
Exactly. Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. As always, pleasure to talk with both of you. Thank you.
Thank you,
Cindy. Always a pleasure.
Collaborative.
Experimentation.
The next idea.
We need a participation revolution, and we need it fast.
One of the persistent messages that we've heard through these many months of The Next Idea is this. STEM careers are critically important to Michigan's economy, and there just aren't enough students coming through the science, technology, engineering, and math pipeline to fill the STEM jobs Michigan will have. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea believes one very good way to address the shortage of STEM professionals is by taking steps to bring minorities and women into these fields. Dr. Kelly Christopher began her career as a civil engineer with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She's the founder and president of MindBoggle. It's a kid-centered STEM programming business. And she's the director of STEM Greenhouse, a nonprofit with a mission to improve math and science education for minorities and girls. Kelly, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you.
You describe growing up in an inner city neighborhood. I'm wondering what kind of career you saw for yourself as a child.
Well, I was fortunate that I did come from a family of educators. So I think I pretty much thought that eventually I would become a teacher, and I think I have in many ways. But I never knew anyone who enjoyed math or science, never had an opportunity to engage with anyone who was an engineer or a scientist or even a medical professional. So the people in my world were generally teachers or, you know, just the moms and dads of my family and friends who sometimes worked in factories or had some other type of administrative job.
And when and how did you first become aware of STEM and the possibility of a STEM career?
Well, I think the first time was in high school, actually. I know that's quite a leap, but I really didn't know anything about engineering or science until I got to high school, and I was in the 10th grade, and I was sent to the University of Michigan for a SWE, the Society of Women Engineers. They had a camp, and that was my first experience with STEM.
And you were saying in your essay that these summer programs, as you say, one white man after another, or maybe an Asian man here and there, were there telling you how wonderful STEM careers were, but you didn't see anyone that looked like you.
Yes, that's so true. And it's kind of interesting because there weren't even a lot of women, to be honest. This program that was for the Society of Women Engineers, the faculty were not necessarily women, but there were some students who were helping and guiding us, but there certainly weren't any African-American women or any African-Americans for that matter. And I remember, you know, there were a few of my friends that had gone to this particular summer program with me, and it just didn't seem like it was a good fit. It was nice, but I just couldn't picture myself being there and working with these people.
Well, how did you get over that doubt, that wall of doubt, and you persisted and you became a civil engineer?
Initially, I would say it was an experience I had with one of my friends. One of my friends was a year older than me. She had gone to college, and she majored in engineering. And it was really, I don't know, I had always been good in math and science, at least in high school. So, yeah, that was a little bit surprising to see her going into engineering. It almost gave me permission to even consider it as an option. At that time, I would say it was about April or May before my freshman year of college, and I was still undecided as a major, and after talking to her, I went ahead and selected, and actually I selected agricultural engineering as my major, but professionally I've been a civil engineer.
Now, the opening point, Kelly, you make in your essay for The Next Idea is really an interesting one. You note that people trying to solve the STEM shortage problem are either educators who really don't know what it takes to be a STEM professional, or they're STEM professionals who really don't know how to teach and reach kids in these underrepresented minority groups. What has that led to? I'm wondering what some of the efforts, maybe well-intentioned, that you've seen that fall short of what's needed.
Well, and I mentioned this a little bit in my essay, but when I go to a school or I speak to a school district, they may say, well, you know, there's a robotics club at one school, or even if you do happen to have a robotics club at one school, it's only, you know, 10 kids that are participating in it, and that's not all of STEM. You know, a robot is not representative of all of the diversity in that career field. You would never know. But someone who is an educator, to them, STEM, that might be all that they know about STEM. And in addition, when I, you know, if I speak to someone who is an academic, you know, they are used to teaching college students. They certainly are not familiar with younger K through 12 students, and especially students who perhaps are in areas of high poverty. So they can't relate to them culturally, and then there's just a lot of obstacles that would prevent that student to becoming successful, and sometimes they don't know how to address that.
But I'd like you, if you can, to kind of give us some of your ideas for getting more minorities and more women into STEM careers and moving beyond the robotics competitions or the STEM nights at schools to something that's deeper and has a more profound impact.
I think that one reason that the STEM night or that math night has become very popular is because schools are trying to address this in some way, and this is all they can really come up with, but it should only be a small part of an overall plan to encourage STEM careers among students. Part of this is academic preparation, and I think a lot of schools are trying to focus on improving mathematics and how they're teaching, and but more, I believe they're trying to teach to test so that their scores are a little bit better, but that's only one part of it. There really has to be more of a comprehensive thought, and it really is just going to take some more investment. I mean, it's sad to say it, but it's you just can't wish it into existence. Somebody has to get really intentional about not only providing the STEM night, but providing tutoring, providing mentors, and opportunities and experiences for students so that they can even know what the STEM career is and what it looks like. And the people, hopefully people who, a diverse representation of people who are coming to the students and saying, hey, I'm an engineer, and if I can do this, you can do this. And I know that when I'm working with students, whether they're African-American like me or if they're from another culture, you know, I might be the only African-American engineer that they ever meet in their entire life. So I just want them to identify with me. I'm a regular person. I'm just like them. I went to school just like them, and I was able to become an engineer, and they can too.
So it's people in the STEM fields making sure that they reach back to kind of bring these youngsters along, and also then at the beginning of it for strengthening basic academics so the kids can succeed once they're in college.
Yeah, and the thing is, just having someone who is an engineer or scientist come into a class and speak once, or, you know, that's one thing, but developing a relationship where they know this person and know their families. You know, when I was in school, I thought that someone who was a scientist, like, didn't even have a family, that they were antisocial, that they just didn't do the things that I did. They didn't go to church. They didn't have children. You know, I just had this perception based on media of what a scientist or an engineer was. And so it's important for kids to be able to develop these relationships. Now, this is not easy because scientists and engineers often have jobs that require them to stay busy and travel. But there are some organizations that have been really generous with their employees, allowing them to have some time to go to schools, as well as just people and programs like the STEM Greenhouse that try to connect people so that they develop that meaningful relationship. It's not the one day at the school STEM fair or something like that.
Kelly Christopher, your essay for The Next Idea, the title of it really does say it all. STEM isn't built in a night. You'll find the essay at the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. We certainly welcome your comments there, or at Michigan Radio's Facebook page, or on Twitter at Next Idea MI. Dr. Kelly Christopher, it was great to talk with you, and thank you for sharing your thoughts with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. That well-known aphorism from Spanish-born American philosopher George Santayana is as true today as it was a century ago. State lawmakers are working on a bill now, House Bill 4493, that would require schools in Michigan to teach students about genocide, including the Armenian Genocide and the Holocaust. Corey Harbaugh is making it his personal mission to ensure teachers in Michigan have resources and models about Holocaust education and to help them teach it well. Corey is part of the education efforts of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington and with Michigan's Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills in Oakland County. Corey Harbaugh also teaches with the Fenville Public Schools in Allegan County. Welcome to Stateside, Corey.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
Corey, why do you believe it is so crucial for Michigan schools and Michigan students to dig into the Holocaust and learn its lessons?
The Holocaust, in my experience as a teacher and as a teacher developer, is one of those teaching content opportunities that we have that in so many ways is what called us into the profession. It is deeply engaging, and when done well and done right, it wakes students up to their place in history, and it also engages them in ways that, you know, we really dream about in our profession. As we push towards more STEM opportunities and science-based focused in classrooms, as we look at early childhood education, you know, one of the things we always have to consider, where are the humanities? Where is our consideration of our civic responsibility to one another? And this particular bill addresses that.
Now, you made an interesting comment that teaching about the Holocaust, when done well and done right, which leads me to wonder, in your work, have you come across inappropriate ways of teaching the Holocaust? What does that look like?
When I first started teaching about the Holocaust, I was doing so in an English language arts classroom in high school, and I was teaching Elie Wiesel's Night. And the first year that I taught it, at the end of the unit, I did a reflective writing with the kids. And one of the kids told me very directly that at the end of the unit, I really left her hanging out there with questions unanswered and feelings unprocessed and curiosities that had nowhere to go. And I realized that I had done her a disservice. And so that started me on my journey to learn more about the Holocaust and content and also responsible ways of teaching it. And since that time, as I've gone into professional development, starting with the Memorial Library, then to the Shoah Foundation and the USHMM in D.C., what I've learned is there is so much variety in the ways that teachers approach it, and sometimes it's done as an experience of trauma, and that happens when a teacher puts material in front of a student, like a photograph that has graphic imagery in it from a concentration camp or something, or it happens when a teacher, a well-meaning teacher, puts a piece of popular, say, a movie or a popular fiction in front of a kid that treats the Holocaust as a fable or distorts the history in some way, and the student comes out with a distorted sense of the history. Mm. Or it happens like it did in my case when I didn't consider the ways that we responsibly take a student into learning about the Holocaust and out of learning about the Holocaust so that there is a developmental appropriateness to it, and at the end of which the students are saying, okay, I understand this leg of the journey, now I'm ready for the next, rather than at the end of it saying, this is undone, or I have questions that are unanswered.
Or shutting down, which I think can easily happen when you think of, you know, the horrific photographs taken by the Allied troops who liberated the camps. If you just put that up there as part of a lesson, you could probably just have a youngster just shut it down totally. I don't want to know. I don't want to know.
And we should never get to the end of a unit of teaching about anything, but particularly with the Holocaust, when at the end of it, students are saying something like, okay, you know, been there, done that, I get the Holocaust, and I don't ever have to learn about it again. That's irresponsible. But it's more irresponsible at the end of which when students say, I never want to encounter these topics again because that was such a traumatic experience. That's not the goal of any education, and we do a disservice to kids when it happens that way.
Corey, you also say that your approach to Holocaust education, that it must have local relevance. So I'm wondering, how would you teach differently, let's say in Fenville, which is, as you told us, is about 50% Hispanic, compared to, let's say, a white-majority community or Muslim-American community like Dearborn?
In our work with teachers across the state of Michigan every summer, one of the things we ask them to do is to think about the content through the lens of their local community and the needs of their students. And students have to see their place in the content. And that's not just true for Holocaust. That's true for any education. It has to have a relevance. But with regards to Holocaust Ed, students who feel a connection historically, maybe students who can trace their ancestry back into Europe, have a different response. And then students who trace their ancestry back or their religion or cultures back in different ways look for their place in the history, and we need teachers to think about what that looks like so that the learning is just as relevant for them. So, for instance, in Fenville, which is 50% Hispanic, many of the students who look at stories or survivor testimony feel or connect with it differently, and they want to know their place in the history, which is why the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, for instance, has been working to develop resources that help students who come from Central and South America see that there indeed were connections to events that happened in Europe in the 1930s and 40s. And students who come from other communities see their places in that as well. And we found that working with teachers to make it locally relevant is the key to having it be the kind of education we want for kids.
Now, your mission is to kind of get the resources and the training to the teachers in Michigan, particularly as House Bill 4493 makes its way through the legislature. And if it comes to the point where they are going to have to teach about it, you want it done right. And I'm very interested in this seminar for teachers you do every summer at the Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills, funded by the estate of a survivor.
That's correct. Olga Lenya was a survivor who made it to the United States after a series of events. But essentially, she survived the Holocaust. Her story is also part of the story that is told in Sophie's Choice. She wrote an amazing memoir, one of the very first memoirs about the Holocaust, called Five Chimneys. At the end of her life, her estate was left and became the Memorial Library and is now the Memorial Library and Olga Lenya Institute. And the board there is wanting to support, through training and resources, teachers across the country so that they have what they need to be able to teach the Holocaust well. We saw that opportunity and created a satellite seminar in Michigan, and over the last 6 years now have worked with teachers literally from every corner of Michigan, from Berrien County up to the Keweenaw Peninsula, the Thumb, the Detroit area. And what we've done is we've invited teachers to come to the Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills for a week in the summer. And our grant provides the resources to provide housing and materials and training and access to survivors and the fantastic archives and resources at the Holocaust Memorial Center. And we get together and we do what good teachers do. We talk shop and we talk about the different topics that come up in Holocaust and genocide studies. We talk about how one might approach it responsibly. We share resources. We bring in lecturers from around the state and around the country. We really create with the teachers an amazing week-long experience that focuses on that very question. How do you teach this well, and how do you teach it responsibly?
So I'm sure teachers listening, their ears are perked up. How do I find out more, and when is this going to be?
Our seminar this summer is scheduled from July 11 through 16, and teachers, if they go out online to the Memorial Library website, which is thememoriallibrary.org, on that website, if they go to the Satellite Seminars Programs area and click on the Michigan Seminar, they'll see information about the program and also the application process, which is online. And they'll hear back from us very soon.
Corey Habar is a veteran teacher with the Fenville Public Schools in Allegan County, where he does teacher development, and co-director of the Holocaust Education Network. And once again, the website for teachers to find out more about this upcoming summer week-long seminar is thememoriallibrary.org. Corey, it was great to talk with you. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Cynthia, it's been an honor. Thank you so much.
We learned about Corey Harbaugh's work teaching the Holocaust through an email that he sent us here at Stateside. So it's a perfect time to invite you to let us know about something you're doing that you think people through Michigan should know about, or tip us off about someone you know who's making a difference in your community. We welcome your story tips by email, and it's easy to do. Just write to stateside@michiganradio.org. She is calling herself a warrior princess, and if anyone has the right to do that, it is 14-year-old Abby Kopf of Battle Creek. Abby is one of two survivors of the Kalamazoo mass shooting of February 20th. Six other people died. A 45-year-old man has been charged in the mass shooting, but let's not talk about him. Let's talk about Abby Kopf, who has shocked her doctors by going home just 2 months after she was shot in the head. Abby's dad, Gene Kopf, is with us now. Welcome to Stateside, Gene.
Thank you.
It is wonderful to talk with you. I have followed the Facebook page that you and the family set up, Abby Kopf's Recovery, right from the very beginning, and it is absolutely astounding. But I think in order to get a full understanding of just how tough your Abby is, can you give us a sense of how things were when you got the call the night of February 20th?
We were told that she would probably not make it through a night. The odds were high, so we had to rush and get there. Her heart did stop beating during part of the procedures when we were there that night. And I really don't like to get into too much detail about that night because it's very, very gruesome.
Yeah. We had her reports that the doctors were actually preparing to pronounce her. And then your wife, Vicki, realized, no, she's still in there and still fighting. What was that moment like? How did you realize that?
I was holding her hand when it happened about the heart, when her mother a couple hours later felt the fingers interlacing. I was in the other corner of the room. How was it like? I don't know. It was all surreal. I didn't have any emotions at the time.
But she squeezed your wife, Vicki's hand. And then you realize she's still there.
Correct.
And now she's home. And I'm wondering what you'd like to say, Jean, about the care that Abby got at Bronson Methodist Hospital in Kalamazoo and then over at Mary Freebed Rehabilitation Hospital in Grand Rapids. What have they been like in helping Abby back to be home with you?
Clearly, Bronson did a great job, or she wouldn't be here. I think that was one of the things that saved her life, was she was fortunate. Well, fortunate is a relative term, because she was unfortunate that she was in town when that happened. But on the flip side of the coin, she was near a major trauma center with lots of training in these sort of things, who quickly reacted. So they were wonderful. They included us, they included parents as team members, and just phenomenal at Bronson. Mary Freebed did a great job with her physical rehabilitation, and now we're home, and she's doing outpatient rehab in Battle Creek.
Jean, you had people all over Michigan and the country and the world just rooting for Abby and for you and your family. Did you feel that, and did that kind of sense of support help you?
Absolutely. We had people all over the community. We still get tons and tons of letters, which we have not even begun to respond to yet. Some of them are wonderful to listen to. We've had people, this gentleman from the UK who writes these long, wonderful letters that Abigail, I read to Abigail, and she just loves to listen to. But we get letters all the time. We get well-wishing. She goes somewhere, and she's the celebrity of the moment, and everyone comes up and just greets her. When this happened and her mother and I were out and about, we would try to get away from hospital food, go somewhere to eat, and we would never have to pay for a meal. It was just wonderful, and we've had various organizations help us out. A stairlift company has already said they will put in a stairlift for her. It's just absolutely wonderful how the community has stood together for us.
You mentioned that Abigail is now in her outpatient rehab. Tell us how she's doing, and also she's looking ahead, isn't she, to the future. What are her goals?
She's doing very well because she had intensive inpatient rehab at Mary Freebed. So it's more of a continuation. Her goals are to returning being as normal as possible. Very shortly, she's going to have a plate put in to replace the missing part of her skull. She has a huge chunk of skull missing, which was shattered by the bullet, and they had to leave it out to prevent any damage from swelling. She may or may not have to have some plastic surgery for the scars after that. That remains to be seen. That can only be determined during the operation. She wants to just be as reasonably normal as possible. Every day she improves dramatically. We have to be extra careful right now because with no plate on her skull, essentially it's just skin over brain. If she were to fall, even though she has a helmet, if she were to fall, it could be fatal. Mm-hmm. So we have to make sure, even though she walks very well, we have to make sure to hold her. She does have troubles with double vision, which makes reading and stuff difficult. And she has horrible, horrible headaches. And that's probably, as a father, my biggest concern is if she's going to be haunted by horrible headaches for long in her life, or if that can eventually be addressed.
And I bet she'd like to get back in the swing of classes and classmates and the life she had going until February 20th.
That's kind of hard to say. She definitely wants to be with the classmates, but perfectly frank, she has never liked school.
You know, you've been, and your wife, Vicki, have been sharing Abigail's journey with the rest of us through the Facebook page, Abby Copps Recovery. I've followed it since you set it up. Why was it important, Jean, for you to do that?
Well, there are a number of reasons. First of all, every relative and shirt-tail relative in the country was filling up the text on my wife's phone and mine, and it was the only way we could get a chance to breathe. Everyone looked the same place. Helps us out tremendously. And the community needs some sort of closure, and everyone wants to know what's going on with that. So it gives the community something to look at. It just centralizes everything, makes our lives easy, makes everyone else happy. It's a win for everybody.
No one, the understatement of the century, no one ever expects to be in the epicenter of something like what happened to your daughter. And I'm wondering, what do you hope to see come out of what happened to your Abigail?
I really do hope that this helps us address the problem that we're having a serious epidemic of mass shootings and gun violence in this country. It's happening everywhere. On average, it's happening once every other day. And I'm not saying that there's a magic cure for any of it, but right now we as a country seem to say, oh, another shooting, grit our teeth, walk forward like nothing ever happened. And my goal for this right now is just to keep rubbing everybody's nose in it until we had come up with functional solutions, not
just pieces of paper or pandering to various groups out there, but something that actually solves the problem. And since all other developed countries do not have nearly an epidemic like we do, or even an epidemic, maybe an occasional something here or there, clearly there's a solution out there, and it's the problem is unique to the U.S., so we have to fix it.
We have seen other parents, for example, parents from Sandy Hook, become very, very active in interacting with policymakers and legislators. Do you see yourself taking that role, especially as Abby continues her recovery?
Absolutely. It goes without saying. And I have networked with many survivors of these incidents. So, and we're continuing to network. Some of the people we've networked with, it's just we've all touched base and just said we'll get in touch with each other once Abby's schedule is more stable. Everyone knows that our life is just hectic from sunrise to sunset dealing with her issues right now. But as the dust settles, absolutely, we're going to become more involved with it.
Gene Kopp of Battle Creek, I want to thank you for being with us and know that you and your wife, Vicki, and your daughter, Abby, have the very, very best wishes of so many people who are listening to us talking right now.
Thank you very much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Melissa Benmark, Mike Blank, Josh Hakala, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.